So one of the challenges of this retreat is that we begin again with the instructions, to a certain extent with the talks. Half of you have been here for 2 weeks. Half of you have just arrived. But regardless of whether you've just come or whether you've been practicing for a while, it's always very helpful to go back to the basics. Because as we cycle back through them again and again and again, we often hear things we never really received before. We're in a different place in the practice. We have different questions, different issues. So today, I want to begin with some reflections about the instructions. We come to metta practice, we come to Myanmar to develop this beautiful quality of heart and mind that is metta, loving kindness. We come to free the heart from any form of ill will, aversion, or fear. So we all sit down and Saito gives his very basic Burmese style instructions. And this simplicity has a very long tradition. Really, the main metta instruction in the original texts, in the suttas, the most predominant metta instruction that appears many, many places, is basically the chant that we do in the evening, the four boundless states. Abiding, pervading the four quarters with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Full stop. That's it. The other Sabbe Sata chant we do in the evening, the Metta chant, also comes from the texts, from the Nikayas. And this is from the Patthisambhida Magga, which is a slightly later stratum of text. And as you know very well from having chanted it, it lays out different categories of beings, as well as the four basic metta aspirations. So we can go through these categories with these aspirations for each of them. And of course, there's the Metta Sutta, which also gives very condensed instructions. Just abiding, pervading the world with loving kindness. So all of these basic teachings are very condensed and terse. There's not a lot of detail. And basically, as an instruction goes, none of them really give us much to go on. Besides, you know, abiding, pervading all quarters of the mind imbued with loving kindness. Gee, thanks. You know, how do I do that? So, the beginning of today's talk, I want to address the how do I do that a little bit in more detail. In this Burmese tradition of practice, the detailed exposition of the metta instruction, the metta practice, relies in large part on a text called the Visuddhimagga, which is not one of the primary texts, but it's a commentary that was written in about the 5th century AD in Sri Lanka. And in the Visuddhimagga, which means the path of purification, there's a whole section on concentration. And in this section, there's a whole chapter on the Brahmaviharas. So in that chapter, there is a bit more detail than what's offered in the primary texts, including a fairly detailed explanation of reflections, of categories of beings, of preparatory practices, of benefits of loving kindness, and an explanation that we use still to this day here on how to cultivate loving kindness for a sequential series of categories of people, beginning with ourself, ending up with all beings. And the basic instruction in the Visuddhimagga is that once we're able to feel and know that metta wish for ourselves, which is why we start, one of the reasons why we start with ourselves. Once we can do that, we take ourselves as an example and then begin to offer that wish to other beings, beginning with a benefactor, going to a dear friend, a neutral person, an enemy, and then all beings. Saying basically, just as I wish to be happy and peaceful, so may this other person be happy and peaceful. And that's the text that's given in the Visuddhimagga for a phrase. It's still not a very detailed instruction. That's about it. So we say the phrase, we offer this well-wishing to these different categories of people, and we keep going with that. So Sayadaw has been offering instructions based on that, and they're a little more detailed. But compared to what one sometimes finds in Western Dharma centers in America or in Europe, the Burmese instruction is fairly bare bones. A lot really is assumed as common experience, the sort of things, well, it goes without saying, so it doesn't get said. And for a lot of us, the stuff that goes without saying is really helpful to hear. So that's what I want to fill in on a little bit. I was really struck by this last year, 2016. I went to Spirit Rock Meditation Center because I had a little time and somebody had offered me a place to sit, a retreat. And I'd never sat at this retreat center. And it was a Vipassana retreat taught by some friends. So I was going to sit and do Vipassana. And as is common in retreats in the West, there's usually a little bit of metta practice sandwiched in there early in the afternoon. And the first person sat down to give metta instructions and proceeded to go on and on and on. They were very, very detailed and like nothing I'd ever heard. And I found myself kind of going, where did she get this? It was, you know, it began with, imagine yourself sitting surrounded by your benefactors, feel their love for you. And she went on in this vein and, you know, then, you know, notice their goodness and then da-da-da-da-da. And I'm going, oh, this is different. And I spun out, I have to say, in a little bit of negativity, because I was like, oh, this is so psychological. But at the end of the retreat, talking with some of the other yogis, everybody was saying how much they loved it, how much they appreciated it, how helpful it was to receive that instruction. And I thought, I get it. I've been in Burma a while. So I won't be giving that kind of detail. I won't be filling in to that extent. But just to fill in a little bit. Because basically what Sayadaw says is sit down, choose a person, choose a phrase, repeat the phrase, but not in a superficial way. Full stop. So right off the bat, immediately, one thing we as Westerners often need to hear is a single word, relax. Relaxation is essential for the metta practice. If you're not relaxed, if you're tight, it's almost impossible to cultivate loving kindness. The paradox that we as Westerners have a hard time comprehending is that mix of tranquility and alertness that's true relaxation. True relaxation isn't just kind of sloppy, just kind of boof. Neither is it at all tight. So in terms of the posture, upright is optional. Upright is optimal. But with uprightness, we can't hold ourselves stiffly and be relaxed. So there has to be a relaxation, a natural uprightness to the posture. A friend of mine in New Zealand had this really funny card on her refrigerator. It was a picture of a meerkat, you know, these little beings that stand up on their hind legs. And the caption read, "I'm not tense. I'm just terribly, terribly alert." And this, you know, we don't want that kind of uprightness. Relaxed at ease, but sitting with dignity. And what comes with relaxation also is an instruction that's very helpful about how to work with pain. Because in the Vipassana practice that most of us are used to doing, we're told, if you feel pain, if painful sensation arises, know it as it is. Don't give in to the wanting to move. Simply feel it. Know it. Experience it in its essence. But with the metta practice, the instruction around pain is different. The instruction around pain is to let it be in the background. And if you need to move, move. Being careful with that instruction, not to give in to restlessness. But if something is really painful, slowly and quietly, so as not to disturb your neighbors, move the body, adjust the posture. So relaxation is important. The second thing is about where and how to pay attention. It says nothing in the Visuddhimagga about what to do about this. It just says radiate loving kindness. So we, as Westerners, often begin to go here and go, may you be well, happy, and peaceful. May you be well, happy, and peaceful. May you be well, happy, and peaceful. And it stays about from here up. And it becomes mechanical. So often in the West, the instruction right at the beginning, which is not in the original text, but is very helpful, is to drop, as when you sit down, to drop your attention into the heart center. Rest the attention there. I like to think when I'm doing the practice of letting the metta phrases come from here, down here, not up here. So it can be very helpful. Sometimes people have a hard time even feeling anything here. So it can be very helpful at the outset, when you sit down, after you find a comfortable posture, to breathe into this area, to simply feel it with a kind, friendly attention, with a metta attitude. You can put your hand here if it helps. Sometimes you see people with two hands here. It's like it's very helpful to bring a heightened level of sensation there if you put your hand on your chest. Breathe into this area. Feel it. Because if the metta phrases, or the metta phrases when they come from here, it brings our consciousness down to the heart. And the metta practice is all about opening the heart, softening the heart. And you can't do that from up here. And this is one of those, it goes without saying things. Because at the time of the Buddha, I am guessing, if it's like anything like today, most people assume this is where the mind is, if they're Asian, particularly Burmese. The mind is here. The mind and the heart are the same thing in Buddhist psychology. We tend to think of the mind as a thing that's up here. But what's very interesting is, even though that's our primary kind of idea, if you ask somebody to say, or point to yourself, they go, oh, I'm me, right here. So we still have this sense of, this is me, down here in the heart. So breathing into the heart center and beginning to radiate a loving kindness from that place. And then third, about the metta phrase itself. Not the phrase, not whatever phrase you choose to use, but more about the attitude. The attitude to bring to the phrase being one of connecting. It's not a mantra. It's not certainly an affirmation. Instead, it's an articulation of this metta wish. It's an expression in thought of this metta wish that we're cultivating. So how to connect? We use this word a lot, connect, connect, connect. And this is the mindfulness aspect of loving kindness practice. As it says in the Metta Sutta, the line that we chant, one should sustain this recollection. In the original Pali is literally, one should sustain this mindfulness. So we pay attention. And sometimes it feels like it gets very complicated because we pay attention here in the heart center. We pay attention to the person for whom we're radiating loving kindness, to that felt sense or that image. We pay attention to the phrase. And the active well-wishing, the planting the seed of loving kindness, the offering. So it's very easy to get kind of all tied up in knots about these four things if we're trying to do them at the same time. You can't. The trick with the metta practice is that there is no hurry. There's no need to rush. It's not about saying the phrase as many times as you can in an hour. So it's very helpful to be deliberate, not to be in a hurry. So for example, in an unhurried way, when we sit down, to take a moment to come home to yourself, connecting with yourself at the heart center. Then, sometimes you can even pause there. Then, take a moment to connect with the being for whom you're radiating loving kindness. Again, no hurry. Either visually as an image or just as a felt sense. And then slowly repeating the phrase. Pausing if you need to get a visceral experiential sense of what you're offering, what you're wishing. And sometimes for me, if the metta practice begins to feel very mechanical, I just really pause on each word and remember the felt sense of that. So, well, what is it to be well? What is it to be healthy? Connecting with the experience of that, and then may you be well. Likewise, happy, peaceful. And often when we slow it down like this, we really make an effort to connect with that experience and with the actual offering. The mechanical kind of experience that you can have just falls away. And there's that real vivid sense of, may you be well. And it's these times when the smile begins to come to the face. Quite naturally, it's not contrived. It's like, oh yeah, may you be well. And in this process, there is a role played by both visualization and imagination. As Sayadaw Uindaka has said, there's no need to visualize the person for whom you're radiating loving kindness. The felt sense is enough. That said, some people are more visual than others. And if this is you, if this works for you, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. For some of us, we're more kind of tactile. So there can be that felt sense of being with the other person. And sometimes it can be useful to just imagining offering this person something. Offering them that while wishing. With both a visualization and, if you do anything in the realm of imagination. It's very, very important not to get carried away into papancha, into proliferating thought. Because especially with imagination, this is a place to be really, really, really careful. Because we can tell ourselves a whole story of, oh, we imagine ourselves being with this person and offering them a gift and how happy they are and then what they might say to us and then remembering, and it spins out. So be very careful if you use this, not to go there. It's just a little bit of a crutch that can be useful. And in general, with the instructions, with the metta practice, please remember, it's not about the results for this other being. It's about cultivating the loving kindness here in our hearts. So the metta is the primary thing. And of course, concentration arises. Even sometimes insight arises. But really, to keep the contact with the loving kindness, no matter what else is arising in the practice, is very, very important. And if the practice is boring, if it's mechanical, if it's irritating, regardless of what else it might be, it can be this way. Please don't worry. This can happen. This is very natural. And really, with that, what's important is patient persistence. All we need to do is to keep doing it. It can be very helpful to generate interest if we change the categories of beings for whom we're cultivating loving kindness at first. And this is why Sayadaw has given the instruction to spend part of a sitting on yourself, part of a sitting on a benefactor, or to spend time with different benefactors. It engages the interest. And to be careful with this, that you're not feeding restlessness. So if you change a category, or if you change to another person in the same category, make the change not out of a reflex of aversion or judgment that sounds like, well, this isn't working, maybe I should do something else. This is never a good reason to change the category. But really, if you change the category, do so from a quiet heart, deliberately, not as a knee-jerk reaction to boredom or impatience. And I've said this before, so those of you who have been here, please excuse the repetition. But really, just as context, the metta practice is a training and a purification. So often what comes up, especially at first, is anything but loving kindness. So there's no need to avoid this kind of stuff if it comes up: boredom, disinterest, irritation. There's no need to change the category as a knee-jerk response to that. The metta practice just asks that we continue persistently, patiently, to direct the heart, to direct the mind to loving kindness. Over and over again, really re-inclining the mind towards the metta and away from anything else that it would rather be playing with in the moment. Rather than any of those other places we habitually go. Because really, we have to train the heart to incline to metta. We have to train the heart not because we're innately bad or evil, but simply because causes and conditions and conditioning and habits get in the way of the loving kindness. So in the context of training, metta as a training, I want to talk a little bit now about effort. Really just shifting gears from the instruction. Because effort is a key factor in the practice. As Ariya said yesterday, she spoke a little bit about effort. And learning the skillful use of effort and energy in the practice is absolutely essential. Here in Burma, you hear the word, try hard, please make more effort. You hear this instruction a lot. Burmese people are very relaxed and very relaxed about the practice. So often the sayadaws say, make more effort, please try harder. They're coming from this cultural background of taking it easy in the practice. And of course, we're coming from the cultural background of already probably being a little too tight, making too much effort, trying to be perfect, trying to do it right, trying. And we hear this instruction, make more effort, and it just winds us tighter and tighter and tighter. One time I asked my preceptor, Sayadawji Upandita, after having heard this instruction probably 100 times, I asked him, Sayadawji, is it possible to make too much effort? And I expected him to say, heavens no, make more effort. But what he said surprised me. His face got really soft and he said, yes, of course it's possible to make too much effort. Now, looking back, I think, oh, duh, of course. And what he said then, he said, effort can be dangerous if you apply it wrongly. If you have too much effort, things can go way out of balance. And it's not pretty. And I thought, oh, okay. So we, particularly if we have that kind of streak of making a lot of effort already, this is a place we have to take great care around. Because in the practice, we do have to exert a lot of effort. In the suttas, it's the factor that comes up the most. If you pull out all the meditative faculties and the four foundations of mindfulness and all the different lists that the Buddha gave about the factors involved in the practice, and you compile them, effort comes out on top. It's really a thread through the entire teachings, the Buddha is saying. And basically, yes, it was his very last words to his disciples. All conditioned things are impermanent. Please strive on with diligence. So the last words of somebody are not usually, especially of a Buddha, are not fluff. And this was his last possible instruction, you know, make more effort. Please strive on with diligence. So this diligence has to be balanced. It must be balanced. And whether we're doing vipassana or whether we're doing metta, it does take a lot of effort because we're going against the stream of all that conditioning, of all that habit. So we have to have effort, and we have to be very cognizant, very aware of how we apply it. As you well know, repeating the metta phrase is a very simple thing. It's not a hard practice to do. We just sit down, we repeat the phrase. Connect, connect, connect. But it's not easy. It goes against our oldest habits, the self-centered kind of me-first thinking that our ego uses to live in the world and to defend itself in the world. And by extension, kind of on a different scale, our societal, it goes against the societal grain as well, our culture, our Western culture anyway, has deep values of individualism, of competitiveness. So this practice goes against that win at all costs mind that we kind of are marinating in as we grow up, as we work, as we entertain ourselves. I was staying a couple of years ago with a friend in the States, and she had a TV which she didn't watch very often, but one thing she really liked to watch was Survivor. I'd never seen this reality TV thing before, so one day I sat down and watched it with her, and it was crazy. It was these people, everybody trying to be the one on top and, you know, eliminating the others in really difficult circumstances. And to me, it just seemed to cultivate competitiveness and meanness. It was very interesting to watch this show. And, of course, there's The Apprentice. You're fired. And all this starts, doesn't it, at a very early age. We're 5 years old. We're in kindergarten. And they line the chairs up. And there's one less chair than every kid. And you walk in a circle around the chairs. And then the teacher, you know, says, okay. And everybody scrambles for a chair. And there's one kid that loses. And then you do it again with one less chair, and finally at the end there's somebody that wins. So even as little kids we learn this. So the metta practice works to pop this bubble of selfish self-interest, of competitiveness, of me first. It's why it takes so much energy. But because it takes so much energy, it's very easy for us to misapply it. Because while we need continuous effort, at the same time, we absolutely must have a very light touch. Munindraji used to say short moments many times. And that was with respect to the Vipassana practice, short moments of attention, one moment at a time. But that instruction also applies to the metta. Just one phrase, just one word. That's all you need to do. It's not, you know, the whole hour. Just one phrase. And then the next phrase. And then the next phrase. And the effort here is simply to remember to keep doing that. What happens, though, as Westerners, is we misapply this idea of effort and we turn it into trying. We think, oh, if we try really hard, we'll succeed. Or we try to make the metta happen. There's that really famous Zen story that I think most of you have probably already heard about the student coming to the Roshi and being very, very eager and saying, I'm really devoted to the practice. If I work really hard, how long will it take before I'm enlightened? And the Roshi says, 10 years. And the student says, but what if I work really, really hard? 20 years. Wait. What if I really night and day? 30 years. This whole ardent trying habit can be such an integral part of our psyches that we don't even see it. We don't even know we're doing it. It's like we're the little train that could. I don't know if any of you, I think those of you who are American probably got this story as children about this little tiny train who had to pull this great load over a hill and I think I can. You know, it's like we get this as children. We have to try really hard. So being able to identify unbalanced trying effort is a really important part of the practice. And this can manifest at the very beginning of the practice. It can manifest if we've been sitting for 40 years. Of course, it can get more and more subtle. But, for example, say the conditions in the moment are not conducive to continuity of loving kindness and something else is happening. And often we can find ourselves sitting and walking and thinking, I have to work a little harder at this. And maybe if I adjust this or that, I'll get back to good practice. Good practice in scare quotes. So that I'll get back to the metta. Voila, you know, success, done. And when I say it like this, it's almost like a kind of a cartoon. But it's never so blatant as that. It's just it's just what we do by reflex. And that kind of trying is what, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, we're cultivating something other than what we intend to cultivate. We're cultivating the old habits of trying, of grasping, of leaning into the practice. And the funny thing about this is we all know better. Even with just a little bit of practice, we know that we shouldn't be doing this. But we know often, we know it here. And we don't know it really here or see it if we're doing it. We can get sucked into this kind of dynamic in such subtle ways So notice in your practice if there's anything that involves an excess of subtle or not so subtle doing. So, for example, if things go into uncomfortable territory, we may notice that we try to drag experience back to concentration, back to continuity, back to metta, back to where it's more comfortable. That's definitely doing. Or, for example, if we notice things have gone out of balance in one way or another, perhaps we've got too much energy and there's restlessness and a lot of thinking, and we think, oh, too much energy, I have to cultivate the concentration. So we put a lot of trying effort into getting concentrated in the service of balancing the practice, balancing out the energy. This is also doing. Or sometimes it just feels like kind of groping through the meditative toolbox. Let's see. This feels a little out of balance. What do I need to do? I need to find this tool or that tool. We all have our little toolboxes. And we try to manipulate the practice rather than simply repeating the phrase, just keep going. That's a little too simple. We make it more complex. We try to change, adjust, balance. And it can get very, very technical. And this kind of doing is the kind of thing that hides in plain sight. We don't even know we're doing it, but it pervades our entire practice. So really, to watch yourself carefully, paying attention to motivation. So that whatever you do, quote unquote, in the practice, comes from a place of relaxation rather than a place of greed or aversion. So if there's any subtle aversion about something, this shouldn't be happening, or I prefer that to this, or greed, oh, how can I get to the back to the metta? Or that sit this morning was really great. Now, how did I do that? Okay, and then we try to imitate what we did this morning. Any time our motivation for making an adjustment in the practice comes from greed, comes from ill will, that's feeding the wrong thing. But any adjustments we make out of relaxation or ease, that's probably more skillful. And really, if our motivation comes from greed or ill will or any of the kilesa, and we do something in the practice from that place, all we're doing really is making more of that. We're strengthening that habit and not the loving kindness. And one particular kind of unbalanced effort that's really common in a formal retreat situation like this is when people set aside precious time in their lives to come a very long way to practice, we can really put a lot of pressure on ourselves. We don't want to waste a single moment. It was expensive to get here. It was probably not at all easy to find space in your lives to take these 2 weeks or 1 month out to do this. There are responsibilities at home and at work that other people have to cover. So it's not easy to get here. It's not easy to simply sit on the cushion. And there's a particular kind of tightness that can come in this situation that we articulate. It's like, oh my goodness, I've only got 2 weeks. And we set ourselves a deadline. We make a lot of pressure. And here's where the big picture is incredibly helpful. Think of it as a lifetime of practice. Not 2 weeks, not even just today. It's like a very long journey. You're pointed in the correct direction, so just keep walking. One step after another step, after another step, after another step. Trusting that step by step by step, the development of loving kindness is proceeding. You might not feel it, you might not know it consciously, but it does work. And there's a verse in the Dhammapada that I like very, very much that articulates the importance of inclining to the big picture. It's Dhammapada 122, and it says this: do not ignore the effect of right action, saying, this will come to nothing. Just as drop by drop the water jar is filled, so in time the wise become replete with good. I thought of this verse this morning because when I woke up, the bucket in my bathroom was overflowing. I had left it empty last night. But the tap was on just enough to allow a drop of water through. And it had been dripping all night. And sure enough, the bucket was full. And I thought, oh boy, that's a teaching. It wasn't flowing, the water. It was just one drop after another drop after another drop. Not even very fast. And the practice is like this. And we don't see the water jar filling. We don't see the bucket filling. But if you look at your practice over a span of years, decades, I guarantee you'll see that you've changed. That there's more wholesomeness that's habitual, less unwholesomeness that's habitual. So, using this big picture to balance the effort. Relax into it. It's okay if you have a sitting or a walking or a whole day or a couple of days of challenge. This is part of the practice. It doesn't mean you failed in this retreat. Even if you have 2 weeks of that, you've been doing the practice. That's fine. That's what you're here to do. And drop by drop by drop, the metta deepens. And while the sayadaws are very correct, they're right when they say effort is important. The quality of ideal effort, which, by the way, is unique to each of us and unique to each situation, but this quality of ideal effort is really one of patient persistence. rather than manipulation or manufacture. So it's not to try to make anything or do anything or construct anything. We can't. The metta doesn't work that way. But just to patiently and persistently keep doing it is all we need to do. There's a beautiful line from Rumi. He says, "Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you've built against it." So if we assess the practice as somehow deficient and then try harder to fabricate metta, to make metta, to get back to metta, however we articulate that effort of trying, we're only building those barriers higher. The good news is when we do this, we can learn from it, you know, and more deeply understand by simply allowing and knowing whatever is arising and kind of holding it with metta. This is enough. And if we have that tendency for trying really, really hard, often when we first kind of dial back the effort and just apply the right amount to keep going, it can feel strange. It can feel a little odd and maybe not, quote unquote, right. I must be doing this wrong. It's too easy. We can feel guilty that we're not doing it right or ashamed. I remember I was sitting in Barre in Massachusetts doing a very long retreat. And I'd been dealing with some really kind of big kilesa knots. Finally, one afternoon after just trying really, really hard, wrong effort, I have to say, for a long time, I finally just said, oh, to heck with it. I'm going to go for a walk. I never went for walks. So I went out into the forest and just said the metta phrases. And I reported that in an interview. The whole time I was doing it, I felt guilty and ashamed. It's like, oh, I'm failing. I'm just walking through the forest saying the metta phrases. I reported that to the teacher the next day, and she said, well, did you connect with the metta? And I said, yeah. And she said, and you were doing it wrong? She said that quite sarcastically. You know, it's like, that's exactly what you needed to be doing. But I was so used to trying really hard that it just felt really wrong. It felt like I was making a big mistake. It felt like I was wimping out. It felt like I was cheating. But there's nothing to worry about. If you're feeding the wholesome and starving the unwholesome, you're doing the practice correctly. And really, that's what I was doing in that circumstance. And that's what you do if you dial that trying back and just relax into repeating the phrase, connecting as best as you can. So if we follow the instructions and apply whatever balanced effort looks like for us, if no matter what is arising, we simply keep doing the practice through all the ups and downs, the metta will inevitably arise and become consolidated, pretty much effortlessly and by itself. And a number of you have experienced this. You've come in to report and you say, oh, yeah, you know, I was having a really bad afternoon, but I just kept going. And then, wow, the effort, I didn't control it, but, you know, the metta just came all by itself. That's exactly it. We just keep doing it. And in maintaining whatever relaxed effort we need to maintain to keep this continuity going as best as we can, and it's not going to be perfect at first, but if we just keep doing this, we're creating the conditions for the metta to arise. We can't create the metta, but we can create those conditions. I want to end with a passage from the Anguttara Nikaya. The Buddha says this: it is impossible for ill will to persist in obsessing one's mind. When one develops and cultivates the liberation of mind by loving kindness, if one properly undertakes it, there is no such possibilities. For this, friend, is the escape from ill will, namely the liberation of mind by loving kindness. So may each of you develop and cultivate this beautiful practice of loving kindness with ease, with balanced, with relaxed effort, escaping beyond the reach of all forms of ill will, of all forms of attachment, of all forms of fear.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.